of Iranian women are literate, and 60% of Iranian university students are female. Today, 43% of Iranian civil servants are female. Women make up 43% of employees in the government sector. From a total of 2.4 million jobs in the government-owned sector in Iran, 1.1 million jobs are filled by women. Clearly, the huge increase in the number of women university graduates in Iran has had a considerable impact on Iran's economy, with many top jobs in Iranian industry, academia, and business now being occupied by women. Iranian women were given the right to vote in 1962, but before the Islamic Revolution, few women exercised this right and their participation in elections, for example, parliamentary elections, was very limited. But today, about 17% of those who have been elected to the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, are women, and the average participation of women in presidential, parliamentary and local elections in Iran is about 55.9%, a very respectable figure. In his recent meeting with women from all walks of life, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, emphasized that today women can be seen among top Iranian industrialists, top Iranian scientists, engineers, researchers, professors, doctors, and surgeons, whereas before the Islamic Revolution, only a handful of such women existed. The leader poignantly added, "All this progress has occurred after the Islamic Revolution. The status of women has gone up tremendously, and we see huge numbers of successful women in business, academia, and industry. In sports too, about 16,100 sporting clubs are active specifically for women in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iranian women have managed to win a total of 3,302 medals in various sporting events post-Islamic Revolution. 51 women have been elected or appointed as the head or deputy head of sporting federations in Iran, and 70 women have headed sporting delegations at the provincial level. This is quite an achievement for Iranian women."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the Newsline.
The harsh treatment of the Israeli regime against Palestinian prisoners is continuing unabated. At least 120 Palestinian inmates in an Israeli jail are on hunger strike in protest against the regime's repressive measures. The Palestinian Prisoners Society has said the Palestinian political prisoners started the mass strike to protest against the inhumane conditions at Israel's notorious Negev prison.
Ben-Gavir announced plans to implement several punitive measures against incarcerated Palestinians, and he's continuing with more aggressive decisions. These measures are meant to drag the Palestinian prisoners into confrontations with the soldiers.
The commission said the inmates announced their decision to launch a hunger strike in response to the new repressive measures imposed on them by Israeli prison authorities. The development came after Israeli forces stormed several sections in Megiddo, Ofer, and Negev Desert prisons, attacking Palestinian prisoners and placing a group of them in solitary confinement. The Palestinian resistance factions have warned that the tension in prisons will not stay within their walls. They say harming the prisoners will have repercussions within and outside Israeli prisons.
The vicious attack on the prisoners will lead to serious consequences. The prisoners are not alone. They always find support and serious stand from the whole Palestinians. It seems this current regime wants a war on all fronts because the situation in the occupied territories is already boiling.
Reports say the move is in response to the abuses suffered by inmates in Section 26 and 27 in the Negev, the transfer of others from Section 8 to Section 6 in the same prison, and depriving them of their possessions and basic needs. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held under administrative detention, in which Israel keeps the detainees without charge for up to 6 months, a period which can be extended an infinite number of times. The detention takes place on orders from a military commander and on the basis of what the Israeli regime describes as secret evidence. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years. Rights groups describe Israel's use of administrative detention as a bankrupt tactic and have long called on Israel to end this move.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much and will not break the Palestinian resistance. And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. And nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
There are reportedly more than 7,000 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express outrage at the illegal detentions. Israeli jail authorities keep Palestinian prisoners under deplorable conditions without proper hygienic standards. Palestinian inmates have also been subject to systematic torture, harassment, and repression.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is on the final leg of his trip to Latin America, where he has met with a number of high-ranking officials in an effort to boost bilateral and multilateral relations. Cuba was the latest destination of Amir Abdollahian, where he met with Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel. During a meeting, they discussed matters of mutual interest at bilateral and international levels. The top Iranian diplomat voiced his country's categorical support for Havana while condemning sanctions on Cuba and foreign intervention in its internal affairs. Díaz-Canel, for his part, said despite all the existing pressures, Cuba is determined to cooperate with friendly countries and work with them to eliminate obstacles and challenges lying ahead. The Cuban president criticized U.S. unilateralism and said that his country has earned political independence at a high price and would preserve it. Amir Abdollahian also met with his Cuban counterpart, Bruno Rodriguez Parilla. Both diplomats wrapped the U.S. sanctions policy against others, including Iran and several South American countries, saying such a policy is doomed to fail. Before Cuba, the top Iranian diplomat paid a visit to Venezuela, which is maintaining strong bilateral relations with Tehran. During a meeting between Amir Abdollahian and Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the two sides discussed ways to strengthen cooperation further in various fields, including energy. They also called for heightened vigilance in the face of U.S.-led pressure and bullying. Maduro also pointed to common challenges being faced by Venezuela and Iran. Amir Abdollahian also traveled to Nicaragua as part of his Latin American trip. In a meeting with President Daniel Ortega, he condemned unlawful sanctions imposed by the U.S. and certain Western countries on Iranian individuals and entities. He stressed, however, that the Islamic Republic has managed to move forward despite the coercive measures designed to stop the country's progress. Amir Abdullahian voiced Tehran's eagerness for closer cooperation in various fields, saying Iran sets no limits to the promotion of cooperation with Nicaragua. Ortega, for his part, highlighted shared concerns of Tehran and Managua. He said that the two countries have a common enemy, adding that what Iran fought and defeated in 1979 was the same Nicaraguans rose up against in the same year. Amir Abdullahian's visit to Latin America puts under the spotlight the significance of his meeting with officials there. One of the most important points highlighted by almost all leaders was that the ongoing developments in Latin America and elsewhere in the world are creating new opportunities for multilateralism. That was particularly underlined by the top Iranian diplomat, who dismissed unilateralism as an obsolete doctrine on the global stage. He stressed that unilateralism cannot respond to developments and changes taking place worldwide. In the case of Iran and Venezuela, the officials of the two OPEC members found a common ground to solidify their relations to deal with a common enemy, the United States, which has come up with crippling sanctions against them for years. Standing against the U.S. and Western imperialism was another topic of discussion during the Iranian official's visit. That was underscored in Daniel Ortega's comments, where he said the enemies of global peace and tranquility have maintained their imperialistic policies and considered the whole world, not just Latin America, as their backyard. Ortega, however, expressed hope that imperialism cannot last any longer. On sanctions, Latin American leaders echoed the stance of the Iranian foreign minister, who called such measures terrorist threat being used by imperial powers as leverage. They stressed the need for boosting cooperation in trade and technology, among other things, to overcome those curbs. It seems that shared challenges have brought these countries together to push against U.S. hegemony. And what could make a difference? Moving away from the U.S. dollar, establishing a common currency, enhancing bilateral and multilateral trade. It seems that an oriental shift is largely taking place in today's world. That is visible in countries on the African continent that are trying to enhance ties with the East, namely Russia and China, and Latin American nations that are standing firm against U.S. unilateralism. All these point to their rejection of Western hegemony. The balloon's journey across the ocean has gripped the world's attention. On Friday, the U.S. military said it mobilized fighter jets, but advised President Joe Biden against shooting the balloon out of the sky for fear debris could pose a safety threat. U.S. authorities said the military took custody of the balloon when it entered America's airspace. On Saturday, however, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the balloon, which was being used by China in an attempt to surveil strategic sites in the continental United States, was brought down above U.S. territorial waters. Pentagon also snapped what it called China's unacceptable violation. China has expressed regret, blaming winds for pushing what it called civilian airship into U.S. airspace. Beijing said the balloon was used for meteorological purposes and had unintentionally escaped into U.S. airspace. The incident prompted U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken to issue a personal note to his Chinese counterpart condemning Beijing's move.
China's decision to fly a surveillance balloon over the continental United States is both unacceptable and irresponsible. That's what this is about. It's a violation of our sovereignty. It's a violation of international law.
Blinken further added that the U.S. remains committed to diplomatic engagement with China and that he would make a trip to Beijing once conditions are favorable. Some White House allies say postponing Blinken's trip was an overreaction to the incident, particularly because U.S. officials have said that they do not think the balloon was able to gather information that cannot be acquired in other ways, such as spy satellites. In a phone call with his American counterpart, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said China and the United States should handle occasional individual cases in a calm and professional manner. Wang stressed that China has always strictly abided by international laws and will not accept any groundless conjecture or hype. In the face of unexpected situations, what both sides should do is to maintain steadiness, communicate in time, avoid misjudgment, and manage differences. Meanwhile, the Pentagon said it spotted a second similar balloon flying over Latin America. Beijing already denied the U.S. accusation of spying. It accused U.S. media and politicians of using the recent balloon incident as a pretext to launch a smear campaign against Beijing. The allegation of a suspected spy balloon flying in the sky of Montana has added to concerns that the already heightened tensions between Washington and Beijing would further escalate. Although balloons are a powerful potential surveillance tool, it is odd that Beijing would do something this provocative just before a key U.S. diplomatic trip, especially since China has been pushing to repair relations with the United States post-pandemic. Some in the U.S. say it is very likely that China has been using this technique for a while and that the United States was aware of it, but diplomatically chose not to respond. A U.S. Defense Department spokesman confirmed that such intrusions have happened before, saying it is not the first time that you had a balloon of this nature cross over the continental United States. It has happened a handful of other times over the past few years, to include before this administration. Some believe that the United States is spending a large budget on creating unnecessary hostility with China. Some others reason out that the tensions have flared up in recent years between the two, with Biden declaring that China is America's most consequential geopolitical challenge and competition between the two global superpowers is intense. After all, Washington and Beijing are already at loggerheads over a host of issues. That includes tensions over Taiwan. President Biden has antagonized top Chinese officials by saying on several occasions that the United States would defend Taiwan if China attacked a self-ruled island. One close ally of the administration said that although White House officials have walked back those statements, Biden is intentionally sending a message to China when he makes such pronouncements. But tensions between Washington and Beijing are not limited to that. The two powers have deep differences on other issues as well. The economic war between the United States and China, with the two countries having imposed tariffs on each other's goods, can be named as such. The U.S. presence in the South China Sea also adds to concerns that Washington and Beijing would be facing each other militarily. In the current situation, one small excuse would be enough for the whole world to wage another world war.
The United States is ramping up its efforts to counter China's growing regional power. Amid Washington's rising tensions with Beijing over the South China Sea and Taiwan, Washington and Manila agreed on plans to accelerate the full implementation of the, quote, Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, with the full agreement to designate four new agreed locations in strategic areas of the Philippines. The deal would allow Washington to deploy military equipment and rotate its troops to four more bases. Washington has currently five bases in the Philippines. The two sides also agreed on the substantial completion of the project in the existing agreed locations.
Today, Secretary Galvez and I also reaffirmed our mutual defense treaty commitments. And we'd note that the mutual defense treaty applies to armed attacks on either of our armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft anywhere in the South China Sea or the West Philippine Sea.
According to experts, Washington's access to those bases could provide U.S. forces a strategic position from which to mount operations in the event of a conflict over Chinese Taipei or in the South China Sea. China has criticized the U.S. for its plan to increase its military presence in the Philippines, warning that granting the U.S. greater access to military bases by Manila could hurt regional stability and raise tensions. The move is part of U.S. plans to encircle China's maritime border in anticipation of a war over Taiwan, which Beijing considers as its own. Last year, tensions rose to unprecedented levels after the then U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island. China has repeatedly warned against any attempt that delegitimizes its national sovereignty. Furthermore, China claims sovereignty over virtually all of the South China Sea, which is also claimed in part by Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. The waters are believed to sit atop vast reserves of oil and gas. In another attempt to counter China, the U.S. has opened an embassy in the Solomon Islands after a 30-year absence as it seeks to boost diplomatic relations in the Pacific. The last U.S. embassy in the Solomon Islands closed in 1993. The move comes after China struck a security pact with Solomon Islands last year. It was the first known bilateral security agreement between China and a country in the Pacific. The region has become the center of a geopolitical and strategic tug-of-war between China and the U.S. Meanwhile, NATO, which is a U.S.-led military bloc, is trying to bolster its ties with Japan in a bid to strengthen an alliance against China. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has visited Japan, saying the Western military alliance will continue to strengthen its partnership with Tokyo.
Beijing is watching closely and learning lessons that may influence its future decisions. What is happening in Europe today could happen in East Asia tomorrow. So we must remain united and firm, standing together for freedom and democracy.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and in recent years, it has expanded its military ties with other Indo-Pacific nations, as well as the United Kingdom, Europe, and NATO. Back in December, Tokyo unveiled a new national security strategy that will see a large increase in its military capabilities. The strategy includes the deployment of long-range missiles. Japan also hopes to ease restrictions on arms export to strengthen its military industry.
Choose to think better. Welcome to A Better You. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآنك جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسانك ودعوتك ربي بقرآنك.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه.
السلام عليكم. Respected brothers and sisters, dear listeners, welcome to IRIB English Radio. Here again, we are with you in another Quranic session. Brother Fawad Haider is here, Brother Hassan Nasrullah, Hussein Ruhullah, and Ali Nasir, students of Xavier International School. So, we are here with you with another Quranic session. Welcome, everyone. So today, the same as our previous sessions, inshallah, we will go to one of the verses of Surah Al-Baqarah, ayah number 270. Yes, 270. On page 46. So, brothers and sisters, as you are listening to IRAB English Radio, please hold your Quran, turn to page 46, ayah 270 of Surah Al-Baqarah. So, we all will once listen to the recitation, then inshallah we'll go to the explanation with the tajweed rules. All right? Hassan, Hussein, Ali Nasir, and Fawad, are you ready to listen?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Let's listen.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وما أنفقتم من نفقة أو نذرتم من نذر فإن الله يعلمه وما للظالمين من أنصار.
Nice recitation. I will be reciting, okay, Fawad? Make sure you and your friends will recite after me, okay? Brothers and sisters, please practice after us. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
وما أنفقتم من نفقة أو نذرتم من نذر فإن الله يعلمه.
وما أنفقتم من نفقة أو نذرتم من نذر فإن الله يعلمه.
أحسنت. وما للظالمين من أنصار.
وما للظالمين من أنصار.
ما شاء الله ما شاء الله. وما أنفقتم من نفقة أو نذرتم من نذر فإن الله يعلمه. Whatever charity you may give or vows that you may vow, Allah فإن الله يعلمه. Allah indeed, what? Knows it. Yes? Allah knows that. وما للظالمين من أنصار. And the wrongdoers have no helpers. The wrongdoers have no helpers. Guys, sometimes this is about tawheed, all about tawheed, okay? فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ يَعْلَمُهُ. It's all about tawheed. Tawheed doesn't only mean that we should believe Allah Almighty is one. There is only one God who created this world. Tawheed doesn't only mean this. Tawheed has an important meaning, okay? A broad meaning. It means when you believe that there is only one God, you have to believe that this God is knowledgeable. He is the all knowledge. Yes? Tawheed means that Allah is powerful, and you should believe that Allah is the all power. Okay? The first and last power. The all power. When we believe Allah Almighty is Hakim, he is the wise, we should believe that he is the all wisdom. The all wisdom. Whatever wisdom we see in the world is for Allah. Okay? Allah Almighty has given those who are wise. Allah Almighty has given them wisdom, power, knowledge. Yes? Mercy, kindness, love. Okay? Generosity, honesty. Everything, the complete version of all these attributes is for Allah Almighty. Alright? So this means tawheed. So sometimes we might think that, oh, even if, what happens if I give charity or no? If Allah wants to give me in return something, if Allah wants to give me something in return, so he should give me. Maybe we don't see the result, yes? You donate. You give 10,000 thumans. Okay? And you might think that, oh, this doesn't change anything. Even if I give this poor person a 10,000 tuman, it doesn't change his life. Come on, it changes your life. Doesn't matter it changes the poor person's life or not, okay? It changes your life if this donation is for Allah Almighty. And in fact, Allah Almighty knows what you do. وَمَا أَنْفَقْتُمْ Whatever charity you give. مِن نَفَقَةٍ It's in نَفَقَةٍ means any small amount of donation. Doesn't matter it's $100 million or 1,000 tuman. Doesn't matter, okay? Or a cent. It doesn't matter. Allah Almighty knows and He will give you a return. If not in this world, for sure He will give you on the day of judgment. In the previous ayat, we say Allah Almighty talked about it. Yes, الشيطان يعيدكم الفقر. Shaitan was telling us that, come on, stop donating. It doesn't change the poor person's life. So it's useless to give him, right? So in fact, instead you have to know that, yes, that changes a lot of things. If that 10,000 tuman does not change anything to you in this world, it changes your akhirah. Okay, that's it. وَمَا لِلظَّالِمِينَ مِنْ أَنصَارٍ And for the wrongdoers, yes, they don't have any helper.
قرآني نبض حياتي قرآني طهر ذاتي قرآني عصمة أمري قرآني طوق نجاتي قرآني نبض حياتي
How to learn Quran easy? What is the correct way to read the Quran? What is the correct way to learn Arabic and understand the Quran? Be with Let's Recite the Quran.
So now we will go to the very, very important tajweed rules, inshallah, we'll mention in this ayah. Make sure, brothers and sisters, you take notes and practice them. Fawad, Hassan, and Hussein, and Ali Nasser are here, inshallah, to help us practice these tajweed rules. Yes? Fawad, the very, very first important tajweed rule here is the pronunciation of the letters. Yes? Sometimes you might pronounce the letter waw as vowel. Vama. It's not correct. Vama. Vama is not correct. Right? Because we don't have va sound in Arabic. It's wa, wa. Wama, not vama. All right? Hassan? Hussein?
Yes.
Okay? It's not vama. It is wama. Right?
Yes.
Anfaqtum. So. وَمَا مَا has a mad on the top. Fawad, you tell me, is the mad wajib to stretch it for six counts?
No.
It's not wajib. Ali Nasir, you tell us the reason.
Because the mad letter.
The mad letter, which is Alif. Alif mad.
Alif mad.
After meme, okay.
Yeah, and Hamza. Hamza,
which
letters.
Is in the next word. Yeah. They are in two separate words. Great. In two separate
words.
So, we don't have to stretch. And it's not a must.
Yeah.
We're
it is jayaz.
Free to stretch them that or not. So you could say وَمَا أَنْفَقْتُمْ or read it Hussein without mat.
وَمَا أَنْفَقْتُمْ
أحسن. You can skip the mat. That's it. أَنْفَقْتُمْ Two important rules are here in this ayah. In this word, actually. Three. So Nun Sakin plus Fa.
Ikhfa.
Ikhfa. Hide the sound of Nun. How do you hide? Fawad? Ahsan. Next rule. Great. Hide the sound. Produce a nasal sound as well. Wama Faqutum. The next rule, Hassan will say. Qaf, which is Sakin. What rule is applied?
Qalqala.
Qalqala. Echoing sound. Great. Hussein, apply the rule.
In Anfaqtum.
Yes, in the word anfaqtum, okay. Produce, apply all the three rules. The mad,
okay.
Do not stretch the mad, it's okay. If you stretch or not, doesn't matter. Ikhfa, then qalqala anqaf. Go on.
وما أنفقتم
أحسنتم أنفقتم here ميم ساكن أنفقتم ends with a ميم ساكن plus next word starts with ميم ميم ساكن plus ميم إدغام مثلين فواد is so good at this أنفقتم nasal sound plus ميم plus نون ساكن yes من and next word starts again with نون نون ساكن plus نون again إدغام right
yes
من نفقتين من nasal sound don't forget it okay وما أنفقتم من nasal sound نفقتين تن تنوين plus next word starts with
Hamza,
Tanween, plus Hamza. Do we have to hide the sound or merge the sound of Tanween or no?
No.
Just clearly read
clearly.
It.
Clearly. Ilhar.
Yes, Ilhar. That's correct. Al Nadar Ra. Ra is very important, okay? Tafkhim. Al Nadarutum. Again, Mim Sakin plus Mim, Idgham Mithlain. Nadarutum Min. Again, Idgham. Min Nadrin. Do not. Do the tafkhim rule, okay? Tafkhim rule. Nadrin, lightly. Nadrin, ikhfa, right? Tanwin plus fa. Nadrin, fa'in, nallaha. The letter lam in the word Allah has to be pronounced
heavy,
with
heavy.
A heavy sound, with an ah sound. Fa'in, nallaha. Why? Because
there is
a fatha sound before. Great. Fa'in, nallaha, ya'lamuh. If you stop. Qila tells you it's better to
stop.
وَمَا لِلظَّالِمِينَ heavy sound. وَمَا لِلظَّالِمِينَ مِنْ أَنصَارٍ مِنْ نُنْ سَاكِنْ بْلَسْ حَمْزَ إِظْهَار but أَنصَار نُنْ سَاكِنْ بْلَسْ صَاد إِخْفَى with heavy letter. أَنصَار أَنصَار that's it. وَمَا أَنفَقْتُم مِّن نَّفَقَةٍ أَوْ نَذَرْتُم مِّن نَّذْرٍ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ يَعْلَمُهُ وَمَا لِلظَّالِمِينَ مِنْ أَنصَارٍ That's it. We alhamdulillah mentioned the very important tajweed rules in this ayah. Make sure, please, brothers and sisters, you practice. And for the explanation, refer to the Tafasir book. Any questions, guys?
No.
We recommend you really, brothers and sisters, to stay with IRIB English Radio. See you inshallah in the coming sessions. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadi wa alihi al-tahirin.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi Muhammad wa ajil farajam.
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
صفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان
Superheroes and Beyond. Part 3.
In a hot night in the summer in the late 1930s, a teenage boy who had recently lost his father in a street fight saw a superhuman character in his dream who had replaced his father. Strong, smart, fast, and protector of security. A superhero that the crisis-stricken American society anxiously waited for so he'd rescue them from the economic problems and injustice of the 1930s.
Fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way.
Not many people thought that the dream of a teenager would be so influential and leave such a huge impact on the future of a country. The Americans of the 1930s were challenged with social and economic problems, injustice, and crime. They needed a source of power who could put an end to their crises. A superhuman solution should have been found for the problems apparently no human being could solve. That was how Superman, the first superhero of comic stories, became the solution to the crisis. It was a DC company that released the red and blue clad man stories for the first time and started the narratives of a superhero. Superman fought against injustice in American society, corrupt officials and gangsters, and supported the oppressed and miserable people. In a period of 20 years after propagating American values, about 78 million children were born during the baby boom. That generation always felt the shadow of a nuclear war. The baby boom generation had become teens who started their activities to take part in society and express their demands. They needed new heroes to shout their demands out loud. As a generation grew up, the crime rates among the youth during the 60s rose. They lived during an economic boost and would never understand their father's concerns. It was like that generation and their parents were born in two different countries and were in two different worlds. They voted for Kennedy as a young and handsome president. They loved the Beatles and gradually started hippie bands. The Vietnam War, with its huge casualties and costs, was one of the shameful decisions in the eyes of Americans, and the opposition had snowballed. Society needed to be convinced. Someone had to sympathize with the people who had lost their sons and daughters. It was Iron Man who was tasked to do so. In the 1960s, he initially supported the U.S. Army's involvement in the Vietnam War, arguing that the U.S. will make a lot of money selling weapons.
For your consideration, the Jericho.
But gradually, he faced many changes. The stories about disgraced Nixon administration. This time, unlike the previous times, the captain didn't become happy after achieving victory, and he abandons the fight. He loses faith in Americans and chooses to become a stateless man. He says, "I've done things that I don't take pride in anymore, but I always tried to serve my country well. Now I can see that the government is serving itself." But social violence in the meanest, scariest, and of course the most popular villain characters in the stories about superheroes reached its climax, the Joker. The Joker showed a strange and very violent and rare behavior. Joker paralyzed Batgirl and tortured her father. Then he displays pictures of the girl's suffering to her father to torture him even more. Until that day, such a horrifying story hadn't been depicted in the world of superheroes. Social violence was at the highest, and Joker reflected a part of the violence. At that time, the stories of Batman and Superman were going forward in a way they had to face each other for a first time. Superman turned into a symbol of a man of law and a tool for the government, while Batman was a man of justice and ethics who supported the people. Borders of ethics were being demarcated by new definitions. The gap between the people and government in the U.S. had put two traditionally popular superheroes at loggerheads. After the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 1990s, the U.S. gained huge global power with its interferences in many countries like Panama, Somalia, and Iraq. It turned into an arrogant power. With its unnecessary wars and bloodletting in different parts of the world, it turned the American dream into a nightmare. The nightmare was revealed in the comic stories about superheroes. In 1992, something happened that was unprecedented. The DC company killed Superman in a battle against a villainous character in Doomsday. His death was a symbolic demise of the American dream. In Marvel, the same thing happened for Spider-Man. He fought with several evil characters that were cloned after him. Evil shadow of popular characters formed a new character and got distant from their bodies. Now you could tell the facade and the inner workings of the U.S. apart. After what happened to the government and the superheroes, people wondered if superheroes should represent ethics or if they could sometimes make mistakes. Should they serve as role models for others or an answer to the audience who are inclined to resort to violence? The final days of the 1990s were peaceful and everything was ready for a turn of the century. But it was the calm before the storm. The most suspicious development was George Bush winning the presidential election.
President of every single American.
Hijacked planes smash into and destroy New York's tallest buildings. Both towers of the World Trade Center collapse with thousands trapped.
September 11th, 2001, and the terrorist attacks was terrifying on a grand scale. Many people blamed the undercover powers in the U.S. for such crisis. The 9/11 attacks left American society in terror. The superhero-making companies were not an exception. Everyone is scared of an invisible enemy who can inflict harm at any moment. At that time, Bush waged the Afghan War under the pretext of the fight on terror, and in 2003, he deployed the U.S. Army in Iraq. The news about the gruesome U.S. prisons and secret places in the world, including in Iraq, were headline stories. Fear from terror made the conditions for the U.S. obscure. Distrust was prevalent throughout society. Terror became the key word in the U.S. media. The situation permeated into the world of superheroes. Terrorists infiltrated into the world of superheroes, and the superheroes realized that the main enemy was one of their friends who betrayed them. That period ended after the Avengers were torn apart and it cast a shadow of fear in the world of Marvel. The story of the Avengers Civil War is about that period. In the mid-21st century, the Civil War is about the cooperation between the superheroes and U.S. government. Their yawning gap with Iron Man on the one hand and Captain America on the other in a confrontational stance. At the end of the story, Captain America surrenders in order to save the government. After Captain America gets arrested, an unidentified assailant shoots him and assassinates the captain. In the story, it's shown that the U.S. and one of its main symbols were the victims of insurmountable terror and insecurity. It gives the thumbs up to continue the alleged war on terror.
Barack Hussein Obama.
In 2008, Barack Obama succeeded Bush and inherited a war.
President of the United States faithfully.
The comic companies kept making stories about terror, and that year, in the ending of the DC story, the evil forces prevailed. Until that time, superhero comics were part of people's lives for about 70 years. During all those years, they try to fully reflect the U.S. society with all of its failures and shortcomings. But now, the border between good and evil had become fuzzy. Actually, the U.S. had caused it because of its global policies. Now, once again, Americans are waiting for a superhero to rescue them from that situation. The economic turnover of DC and Marvel was so high that they decided to step into the realm of movies as well. After 2000, the movies were being made at a faster pace. In mid-2010s, The Avengers became the best-selling movies in the history of the movie industry. In 2019, the fourth episode of the series, Avengers Endgame, became the best-selling movie in the history of cinema. The movie unveiled an evil character named Thanos. The supervillain was born in 1973 in the Iron Man comic book. He's the most powerful being in Marvel, who defeated many superheroes like Avengers, Guardians of the Galaxy, the Fantastic Four, and X-Men many times. Thanos loves nothingness. He collects gems of power from across the world and destroys half of the people in the world. But the concurrence of Thanos' revival with coming to power of an autocratic president once again pushes the idea that comic characters fulfill the unattainable U.S. dream. For a country that doesn't have a very rich history, the superheroes have created a condition so they can continue living in the mirage. The U.S. has passed many tough conditions thanks to the superheroes and has calmed the public opinion through various means throughout history. But today, the crisis hit American society has become several folds more. The image of the American dream isn't beautiful, sharp, and tempting any longer. Now the question is, can the superheroes that the government has always turned to in tough times save America? Now, everyone knows that superheroes do not die, but they turn into different forms under certain circumstances.
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.